So we are wrapping up first the question of why we are here, what Kabbalah has to say about why there are human beings, and what we're meant to accomplish, before moving into Kabbalah and reincarnation. So you know, someone had emailed me in the course of the week to say that she was looking more for information about the resurgence of Kabbalah, why people are interested in it now. Is this something that is legitimate? Or I think as it was worded in the email, is this Jewish? So I put out the poll, and I thank you. There were, I don't know, 15 to 20 people who took the time to respond. And I'd say probably of the responses, probably about two-thirds of the responses wanted to know more about the resurgence of Kabbalah, and one-third said, I want to know what Kabbalah actually says. So we're going to try to provide for both in the course of this. But I do want to make sure to hit the topics that I advertised in the flyer in the first place. The why are we here, reincarnation, red strings, and so forth. So I'm going to do what I can with it, and hopefully we all get something that we're looking for out of it. We started the topic of why we are here by introducing God. And we talked about God as the creator of the universe. We talked about God as the orchestrator on an ongoing basis of the universe via the Sefirot, these influences that God uses in order to send energy, in order to send life to the world. And we talked a little bit about some of the dangers in the concept of the Sefirot as well, the concern that people start to pray to a particular influence that God is sending, the idea that it could lead people to believe in multiple gods. But that was our introduction to God, creator and orchestrator of the universe. We then talked about the universe itself and talked about it from a Kabbalistic perspective as a series of concentric spheres, each sphere being a shell for the layer that is further in. The spheres draw their influence from God in this refined spiritual form. They are, in their most outer form, the spheres are spiritual. And then as you work your way towards where we live, towards our universe, towards the material world, they become less spiritual, more material. And each one sort of influences the next, so that we're all receiving the Sefirot channeled through these worlds. And that brought us to human beings, inhabitants of the innermost world, the most material of realms, and the idea that even for us, we are composed of layers as well, our soul having multiple parts. We mentioned nefesh, ruach, neshama, and the outermost one being the most spiritual, and then working its way down to the physical, and each one drawing influence from the more spiritual realm that is beside it. And that brings us to the practical question of, so what are we doing here? Why have all of this structure? What's the goal? So the first step in order to answer that question is to recognize a basic Kabbalistic idea. It's not only Kabbalistic, but it appears within Kabbalah, of why God wants to create a universe. And I brought it on your sheet in source number 2. I'm drawing on Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin in his Nefesh HaChaim. I'm going to state it outside of the text rather than go through each of the texts as we see them. But you can see there the way that he states it. The core concept of why there is a universe traces to what could be called, in English, the goodness of God. The idea that in order for somebody to be good, they must have somebody to whom they will be good. There is no such thing as being a generous entity, person, thing, whatever, unless there is someone for whom you can be generous. And so God, as a generous giving, I don't know, the word entity is probably the best word I can come up with, there has to be somebody to receive. And therefore, God creates a universe with a vision for benefiting those who reside within. Now, what does benefit look like? Benefit doesn't mean that you get lollipops every day, right? If the idea was that God was creating a universe and just wants to give people lollipops, it would be a very easy thing to do, and frankly, it wouldn't need to involve human beings and free will and so forth. You could just, you know, create a big I don't know what, a big playground, and have have it populated by beings who can play all day and eat when they're done playing, and when they're done eating, then they can go back and play some more. And that would be that, the vision that is laid out for what benefit means and what helping means and giving means is enabling physical entities, material entities, to draw closer to God, to become more spiritual. It's for us too, these material beings who have free will, for us to be able to draw closer to God. That's the concept in a very simplified nutshell that Kabbalah is building on when it asks the question of what we are doing here. And it gives us two jobs. Job number one is keeping the universe going. Job one for us is keeping the universe going. And the other is improving ourselves. By keeping the universe going, we ourselves become benevolent creatures. We also become giving creatures. If you take a look on your sheet at the source, for some reason I numbered it as three. In other words, I skipped one somehow. There's a mystical reason for that. No, it's a mistake in the way I did the sheet. But in any case, if you take a look at the source that's numbered three on your sheet, just as the connection and existence of the human soul in its body is via eating and drinking, and without them the soul will separate and leave the body, so God's connection to the worlds is the secret of the great Adam. In Adam meaning first human being. In order to maintain their existence and for God's Spirit not to reject them, the divine will decreed that this would depend on involvement in Torah and the deeds of mitzvot and the worship of prayer of this special nation. What he's trying to say, what he's trying to get across, is that we actually provide, human beings provide nourishment for the connection of God to the universe via these sefirot. When we study, when we engage in the deeds that we are supposed to engage in, when we pray, all the different mitzvot that we are supposed to perform, and not just Jews with their mitzvot, but the greater world with the laws that apply to all humanity, when we engage in these practices, we are actually nourishing the connection between God and the world and benefiting the universe as a whole. So that much of the focus of Kabbalah is actually, what am I accomplishing when I do a particular mitzvah? When I pray, what is that actually doing? When I study Torah, what is that actually doing? When I recite a blessing before eating food, what is that actually doing? And they will describe higher realms that are being influenced by my actions. So now I turn the question to you and ask, what is the appeal in that for somebody today? We want to talk about the resurgence of Kabbalah. Where is the appeal for that in the person who says, you know what, I want to study a class on Kabbalah? Yeah, Ian?
One of the situations, as I see, a lot of the prayer today for the people who go to school is repetitive and rote.
Yep.
Kabbalah, is it the same? Is it rote? Is it rote?
Well, the prayer can stay the same or not stay the same, well, depending on who's...
I would assume that prayer should not, even if it's the same, one should be a different frame saying the prayer. I'm probably not expressing it properly. Your prayer should be true, different, and you should know a reason for it.
Right. So let me unpack that a little bit. We had a session, one of our summer courses a few years ago was on the origin of prayer, from bowls to books, and how it is that we went from animal sacrifice to prayer. And one of the points that I tried to make at the time was that the prayer that we were given, that the Great Assembly in the beginning of the Second Temple codified, was always meant to be a minimum. It was never meant to be a maximum. This was, say this thing as your starting point, and then you can continue to say beyond that. But I think Ian's point is well taken. The way the world approaches prayer today tends to be, here's the book, I'm supposed to start out on page 54, I'm supposed to read until page 108, and I've done my I've done my prayer. And the result is, rote, the result is ritual without a sense of meaning, because I'm saying words that, number one, I may not understand, to begin with, or number two, may not feel, even if I do understand, because they're the same ones that I said yesterday and the day before and last week and so forth, and it may be hard to find new meaning in it. So one of the things that I think Kabbalah does, without even changing the words of the prayer, is that it encourages the person to think about the meaning of it and what they are accomplishing with it. And I think that does give people a new sense of it. But I think it's broader than that. Yeah, Diane. No, so that's exactly where I'm going with it. What it also does is it says that my actions on a day-to-day basis have meaning and impact. Whatever I do is not simply a secular act with no overtones and no meaning. It is not solely about a ritual that I'm doing to satisfy a personal obligation between me and God, even. I'm maintaining the universe. When I eat food, right, if someone approaches this, and especially if one uses the schools of Kabbalah which have sprung up, and I'm not naming names, but the ones that have sprung up which don't draw on anything Jewish about it per se, but just focus on ideas and attributes without making it something Jewish at all, then all it's saying is, when you eat food, right, I'm going to have an apple as a snack. Eating that apple with the following, you know, types of thoughts going through your head, that's going to help sustain the world, send light and energy, solve the problems of war and poverty and disease and whatever else. For people who are living in a world in which so much of the world is about saying, just satisfy yourself, and that's the most you can hope for in life, this is a whole, it's a whole different way to look at things, and it has a lot of meaning. People have a sense, natively. Rabbi Dr. Avram Tversky, who has done landmark work with addictions over the decades, written many, many books. Fantastic. One of the points that he really likes to hammer in his books, I remember once I went to hear him speak, and he had someone had introduced him and said he had written 39 books. You know what his response is? I wrote one book 39 times. He has certain ideas that he likes to promote. So one of those is that the human spirit is not satisfied if it's only feeding itself. There is something within the human being that wants to do more and that hungers to do more. He talked about it in terms of the idea, which you're no doubt familiar with, you've no doubt thought about, the fact that if you went back 100 years ago and told people about what we would have today, if you told people we would have antibiotics that cure all the diseases that were ravaging children back then, if you told people that we were going to have smartphones and we could tell you what the weather was going to be in Moscow, you know, and I could communicate with people worldwide by video conference, and that we would have reliable power such that we can read and do whatever we like all day and all night as we choose, if you told people that back then, they would say, wow, that's going to be a paradise. People are going to be so happy. And we know what the statistics are on happiness. And we know what the statistics are on depression. And, of course, there are many factors that feed into things like that, and I don't want to oversimplify what are very serious issues. But one of the points that Rabbi Dr. Tversky makes is that the human being doesn't feel satisfaction by feeding himself or herself. Having more toys, having more things, doesn't make us happy. And if you were able to magically, you know, snap your fingers and at that point people would no longer need to work all day long, they would now be able to work for 2 hours a day and they'd have the rest of that time for themselves, you know what you would have? A world of unhappy people. And I think that's what a lot of the resurgence of Kabbalah is about. Because people want to have meaning, they see a system that says, what you do has meaning. What you do is funding the world, so to speak. You are giving energy to, you are influencing the very existence of the universe. You're making people's lives better. And the fact that the way it's, again, taught in these popular settings tends to be without a sense of obligation. There isn't a sense of you have to recite a blessing before you eat. There isn't a sense of you have to keep kosher. There isn't that dimension of it. So that for someone who whether they're Jewish or not Jewish, whether they're a celebrity or not a celebrity, it's the opportunity to have maximum meaning with a relatively low level of investment. And I think that's what drives it. That's what drives a lot of the appeal. Yeah, I remember when this was, I'm trying to think which U.S. president it was. It's a blur at this point. But one of the relatively recent ones had given a big talk at a time when it was Mad Libs. You can just fill in for yourself what the scenario was. It won't matter. You'll recognize it anyway. It was a time of either military crisis or economic crisis, I forget. And he gave a big speech about how people really have to pitch in and they have to work together and rah-rah. And one of the best editorials that I saw afterwards about it was it didn't really resonate with people, and it didn't, based on the numbers that came in afterwards, because he didn't ask for any sacrifice. There has to be some sense of sacrifice. There has to be some sense that I'm giving something up. And on the other hand, people don't want too much sacrifice, which is why he didn't make the demands that perhaps needed to be made.
But also the resurgence. A lot of young people, a lot of people in this generation perhaps don't have a clear vision of God. And if your concept of Tzimtzum is this idea that God nurtures us and our good deeds nurture back to God, is I think that's sort of what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
Is a very pretty idea. That seems so. We're part of God and God's part of us, and we're sort of feeding each other like a mother and a child.
Well, we're feeding the connection anyway.
Feeding the connection.
Yeah.
But if you don't believe in a God, then you don't have anything to feed to. So Kabbalah gives me something to feed to. It sort of says, okay, I don't need the God guy, but I still need the good deeds that God taught me to do.
And interesting.
If I don't have a God, then I still got those good deeds.
Right, I can still be fuzzy about God. And yet have spiritual meaning. It's an interesting idea. I'm not sure to what extent these groups do and do not talk about God, so I'm not sure, but it's an interesting idea for sure.
I think some of the people that are annotating into Kabbalah did have originally the teachings of God, the Zohar is Roman Catholic.
Right.
So she did have the teachings, and then her mother died of cancer, whatever. And so they do have some basis in believing in God.
But it's confused. It's lost.
I mean, I wouldn't talk about a particular person. I wouldn't really draw on the case of a particular person. So it's not really... I wouldn't want her to talk about me either.
Yeah, initially do have a basis of learning about God or spirituality. But then you have this other basis of
I wouldn't go too far with any of the influences we're suggesting are involved to say that this is universal, because I think that, you know, there are some groups for one reason, some groups for another reason. And some groups may have a vaguer idea, and some groups may have actually a developed idea. I think it's possible in any of those. So what they're hearing, the people who are getting into Kabbalah, what they're hearing is, what you do keeps things going. What you do fuels the universe. And when it's not fake, in terms of the question of is this a Jewish idea, you're seeing it here. Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin is as authentic is going to get, in terms of presenting an idea as a Jewish idea. Take a look at source number 4. Again, it's the third source on your sheet, where Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin talks about the fact that human beings are listed at the end of creation. If you look in the Chumash, you look in Bereshit, in Genesis, you find that everything else is created, and then human beings. So he created man, the last of creation, a marvelous creature. And of course, woman being created after him, then she's the most marvelous. A force to gather all of the camps. including within it all of the purities of the marvelous lights and worlds and celestial heichalin, which are literally rooms up in the heavens, which preceded him. All of the individual forces found in all of the upper and lower realms invested a force and portion of themselves in his construction. The human being is a focus for everything. All of the different entities that God created invest in this human being, who is then responsible to nourish, who is then responsible to nurture the rest of them. He's effectively giving back and feeding back to them. How does a human being do it? So take a look at source number 5, please, where he writes, to mend the world of deeds. He talks about 3 different worlds. The world of deed, the world of speech, and the world of thought. And he says you need to engage in action to repair the world of deeds. You need to engage in speech to repair and to strengthen the world of speech. And you have to engage in thought in terms of the realm of thought. Each one has its own level of activity, and your activity is going to purify that and sustain that particular world. And that's the idea that the Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin proposes here. And I should note what I brought you in number 7. He says it's not only about doing this via Torah, via one's mitzvot, via the laws that one fulfills. But if you look at what he says there, even during a brief time when one is involved in earning a livelihood as needed to survive, still in one's thoughts he should think only words of Torah. He suggests that your focus can still be on this activity, even when you're engaged in something mundane. A person who is engaged in a mundane activity can still make it a pure activity, can make it a holy activity, and can engage in this Kabbalistic sustaining of the worlds, even while doing something that is more mundane. That's the idea that he proposes. Now, I should note that there's a negative side also. He writes, I brought it for you in number 8, that just as these powers that we have been given can be used for the positive, they can also be used for the negative. We may have the ability to repair worlds and to sustain energies across them. We also have the power to destroy. We also have the power to undermine. And therefore, he says, you have to watch out for the possibility of having a negative effect. And one last note on this front, I brought it in number 9. Take a look at what he has to say here. He says, when one establishes in his heart the declaration that Hashem is the true God, there is no other force in the world, and all realms are full only of God's simple unity, and he eliminates from his heart entirely, and he pays absolutely no attention to any worldly force or will, and he binds and adheres the purity of his thought only to the one master, then God provides for him, such that all forces and wills against him will be cancelled, unable to affect him at all. And he will also decree, and it will be upheld for him, to perform deeds and wondrous miracles, the opposite of natural forces. What is he saying you're going to be able to do? Sorry? Perform miracles. Sorry?
Fly,
whatever it is. You will be able to perform wondrous things, things that naturally a human being should not be capable of. Which takes us right back to the resurgence of interest in this. Meaning, for people who have a sense of being powerless, for people who have a sense of being vulnerable, there's a promise here that you can be more, that you can be protected, that you will be capable of supernatural activity. Yeah, that's appealing. That's something that will resonate with people, and I think that's part of the resurgence.
But couldn't you say that about groups that focus around, if you like Shabbat candles every week, the world would be a better place? That's the same concept.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. It doesn't require picking up Nefesh HaChaim of Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin or the Zohar or whatever in order to promote such an ideology. Absolutely.
This one is more
esoteric. Esoteric, that's a good word for it. Yeah, I was going to say out there, but yes. Yes.
So I'm a bit confused. So we're talking about the possibility of miracles here.
Yeah.
Is that supposed to be for my benefit or for the universe's benefit?
It sounds like my benefit and therefore the universe's.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's personal and as a result universal. In other words, this human being who is sustaining the world becomes transcendent and is not going to be vulnerable to the things that other people are vulnerable to because they are now tied into these forces which they are helping to sustain, and they just become that so significant that it's sort of in the universe's best interest that they continue to exist, that they be able to do this. So I think it's part of it is personal and part of it is universal. But yes, they end up gaining from this. Is that any less confusing?
No, it's not
going to
matter, but I think it's yes.
No, I mean, I'm not a Kabbalist. I don't claim to have full comprehension of it. I'm able to put it into what I think is English, but you know, I have serious questions about all of this.
I mean, that sounds really like a cult, right? Once you start to get into things like
that. What makes it cult? I think it's an important question. What would make that like a cult?
Because anyone who believes something so amazing,
yeah,
is, I mean, I'm not putting them down. I'm just saying they're going to follow the person who's trying to help them get to that amazing miracle, right?
I mean, there are all sorts of people who teach and promote what I would consider to be, you know, amazing, so to speak, things. I don't think that makes it a cult. I think the cult stage is usually when you're not allowed to challenge, when things have to just be accepted. And if you remember what we said in week one, that is built into Kabbalah. Having nothing to do with any of the groups today, and not making a statement about any of them. But when you have a system in which knowledge is valid because it has been received, instead of because it has been developed, where I'm not able to challenge because this is the way it is, and this is the way it's been received, that's when you get into cult-like situations. I think it's a problem inherent in Kabbalah. I don't think it's because of the superpowers that is there. I think it's there because of the whole concept of a body of information that is so simply because it's so, and therefore is not open to debate. Yes?
How would a person know that they have achieved this quality of who's the judge? Themselves.
Well, no. I mean, to a certain extent, it will be themselves. To a certain extent, it'll be when, you know, they find themselves walking on water. The fundamental question, you know, from their standpoint, they'll say that it comes with a certain feeling, a sense that they are tuned in, a sense that they are being able to influence. I'm not so sure I would trust that, you know, as a demonstration of it, but I think that's what their answer will be. The other piece of this, and maybe this actually speaks to your question also, is beyond the responsibility of we are here in order to fuel all of these realms in which God's mission is fulfilled of benefiting everybody, is that we are here to improve ourselves, to make ourselves more perfect. If you take a look at number 10, the bottom source on the first side, he speaks about the three levels, the nefesh, ruach, neshama, that we've talked about, where the levels within the soul that are of greater or lesser material nature. And he says, the illness and decrepitude of sin in the nefesh may be fixed and even elevated via the level of ruach. And if the ruach is lame, for a person has flawed and warped his ruach via sins that depend on the level of ruach, then the repair comes in the level of the neshama. Each level is supposed to fix the next. So, if I sinned with action, then I have to repair that with the next level up, which is with my speech. I have to make sure to repair my actions, but I also need to repair my speech. If I sin with speech, I have to use thought as part of my repair of that. There's an issue of improving myself, and they have prescriptions for how this is supposed to be accomplished. If you flip the page, I brought you a couple of different points about how the improvement and repair is achieved. One is source number 11. One might cause himself arrogance when he serves God with a pure heart. A person who really dedicates himself to serving God may become self-righteous. He might, God forbid, take others lightly when he sees someone whose service of God is without adherence. That person is not really so committed. And certainly when he sees someone involved in God's Torah and he realizes this person is not doing it with pure intent. In other words, you'll see other people doing things that we think of as, quote, the right thing. But, you know, their motivations aren't great. And you look down on them. He says, in truth, all purity of the heart in serving God is a mitzvah, but not a requirement. He says, you have to respect what people do. Even if they don't have the most pure of motivations. Nonetheless, it's a process. It's growth. And so the steps that somebody takes are valuable for whatever, you know, for whatever level they for whatever level they're on, and hopefully they continue to grow. But each of these deeds and each refinement of a person's character is itself a step towards that repair and towards that improvement. That's number one. Number two, something that Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin stressed a great deal, and in source number 12, I bring it from the preface to the book Nefesh HaChaim that we've been talking about. This is from Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin's son, Rabbi Yitzchak of Volozhin. Some of you have seen this from me before because it's a favorite quote of mine. The Rabbi Yitzchak of Volozhin, in the preface to his father's book, says the following: my father always used to rebuke me, his father, Rabbi Chaim, as he saw that I would not experience the pain of others. This is what he always told me. This is a person's entire purpose. A person is not created for himself. A person is created only to benefit others with whatever power is in his possession. So it's not only about the abstract. Am I focusing on God? Am I focusing on spiritual forces that are channeled from one world to the next world to the next world? It's not only about, am I improving myself and am I drawing closer to God? It's also about, am I feeling the pain that other people are feeling, and am I driven by that to do something about it? It's the bonds between human beings as well. Yeah?
I have two columns in my brain. One's got the Kabbalah on one side and one's got traditional Torah on the other.
Yeah.
I'm trying to understand the difference between Tikkun Olam, which is what I think we adhere to, and what their philosophy is. And I don't understand the difference if they want us to also improve the world.
Yeah, no, I don't see a difference.
There is no difference?
The concept of, you know, as we say in the liturgy, L'takein olam b'malchut shakai, to repair the world in God's reign, that idea is not the property of one of those two units that you describe. They may have different means of getting there, in the sense that what you're thinking of as sort of the Kabbalistic approach may focus more on the Sfirot and their energies and so forth. And doing this mitzvah is now going to channel this force, which is going to lead there and make things better. Whereas a non-Kabbalistic approach, a more, you know, grounded in sort of what I can see type of an approach, is going to say, well, God told me that I should, you know, keep kosher. God told me that I should do this. And these are deeds that I'm supposed to do, which are part of making this world a better place. The goal is not the property of one or the other. It's the means that may be different. Yeah, Ian.
With respect to the tenets and
the
position. Yeah. Who measures
or how does
it measure? With respect
to
the comment about the father always used to rebuke
the son. Yeah. That's the
relationship.
It's the job of a parent to make that kind of an assessment about one's child. And it's the job of a child to reject the assessment of the parent. No, a parent has to be smart and has to recognize parental fallibility, you know, and recognize that there may be things the parent doesn't see. But it's the job of a parent, I think, at least in part, to direct the child's growth and to say, you know, there are areas where we need to improve. Whether you do that directly as a masochist, or whether you do it, you know, less directly, I think that's part of the job description.
But is that the right word, rebuke?
Rebuke is my translation of the Hebrew, and the truth is that the Hebrew word is an interesting word. The word used there in the Hebrew, if I remember correctly, is lahochiach. Lahochiach is a broad word. Sometimes it means to prove, to show that something is correct. Sometimes it means to rebuke. Sometimes it means to educate. I used what the translation that I think comes to mind most. I think if you look at the words that he quotes from his father, those aren't words of harsh rebuke, but there certainly is rebuke implicit in it. In other words, he's saying to him, you got to remember this point. There is an element of rebuke in it, but maybe rebuke is not quite the right translation. Lochiach? No, it's a three letter. But how it would be done is an interesting question. I'm not sure. Okay. So that wraps up for the moment the why are we here